Thank you. I'm sorry.
You're good.
Okay, everybody. We've got another talk before lunch, so we need to get situated here. Bill's from Northern Virginia, so he doesn't understand Stony Point time. It's not up anymore? Uh-oh. I wonder if it wasn't working. I can try video. I don't know. All right, great. Good. Okay, I'll tell you what. Before we get started, really quick, stand up if you've been married over 30 years. Okay. How about over 40 years? Wow, okay, great. There, 41, I know yours. How about over 50 years? Okay, all right, how about over 45 years? Anybody over 45? Realers, okay, both of you. Okay, awesome. And how long have you been married for? Have you been married for how many years? 45? Wow, congratulations. That's so exciting.
Here you go, Sharon.
Sharon and Jack Wheeler. 50 years this year. That's so awesome. Okay, stand up if you've been married less than 5 years. Less than 4 years. Less than 3 years. Less than 2 years. Okay, it looks like we have a winner. And how long have y'all been married for? 8 months. That's exciting. These are Vertalis couple cards, so they can have meaningful conversation during their dinners, right?
Yes.
Okay, Hannah and Nate. All right. Turning it over to you, Bill.
Okay. Can we get together in 30 years and see if you remember anything after in 30 years? Who am I kidding? Okay. I couldn't find my Bible. All right, a familiar passage just to open this next session, which is away childish things. This is from Corinthians, and I will tell you, all you Bible scholars, I am clearly taking it out of context, but this is the beginning of 1 Corinthians 13, which we're all familiar with, and I'm actually going to read from the Message, which is my favorite paraphrase to use just because he has such a different spin. Love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for self. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. Love doesn't strut. Doesn't have a swelled head. Doesn't force itself on others. Isn't always me first. Doesn't fly off the handle. Doesn't keep score of the sins of others. Doesn't revel when others grovel. Takes pleasure in the flowering of truth. Puts up with anything. Trust God always. Always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. Love never dies. Inspired speech will be over someday. Praying in tongues will end. Understanding will reach its limit. We know only a portion of the truth, and what we say about God is always incomplete. But when the complete arrives, our incompletes will be canceled. When I was an infant at my mother's breast, I gurgled and cooed like an infant. When I grew up, I left those infant ways for good. In the NIV, when I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man or a woman, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. and then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. The Phillips says, when I was a child, essentially I saw things the way a child sees things. When we get to heaven, we will see clearly. And Phillips says, but now we see through a glass dimly. And that's the stage that all of us are in. It's like driving with crummy windshield wipers that barely work in a snowstorm or an ice storm, and you're trying hard, the defroster is giving you a little slice of the window to see. That's what Paul is describing our adult life in a broken world is like, that it's actually hard to see where we're going or what God is doing. That's the state of being between perfection and the innocence of childhood. That's the state we're in. What I'm taking out of context is the title of this message. So I want you to think to yourself, what's your answer to this question? And there's obviously no right answer. You already can anticipate what mine is. All couples, at some point, eventually, have to come to terms with blank. Think for a second how you would answer that question. Volunteers. Yeah.
They're past.
Okay, they're past. Yes. What else? Yeah.
Each other.
Okay. Say it again. Yeah, you have to come to terms with the reality of my efforts aren't working. Not nearly well enough. Yeah. That blaming them or resenting them or even sort of shaming them for their past is counterproductive, okay? Other answers, yeah.
Who they are within the relationship.
Yeah, yeah, what I'm, yes. Eventually, you hope. Now, by the way, there's the reason, you know why people quit marriage counseling? The number one reason they quit, because one of the people won't do that. You can tell. Honestly, good counselors can tell pretty early. You figure out who wants to be here, who doesn't, who's open, who isn't, who's willing to change. I'd have a little, if I take my pen, I say I had a magic wand and I could change one of these two people. Who do I want to change? I often ask the couple that question. If you could change, you only got one wish, one change, you can change yourself or your partner. Who do you want to change? You'd think everybody would go like that. Sometimes the people go, no, both people point to the same. I've never had each person go like that, interestingly enough. But Randy's point is right. Marriage counseling doesn't work. It only works when both people are willing to finally say, again, they got to dump all the stuff they're frustrated with, the past, and this is what you're doing, this is why you make this yoked business so difficult. But at some point, what's it like to live with me? At some point, you got to look in the mirror. At some point, you got to realize, if Christ came to dinner, he wouldn't just talk to your spouse. And he wouldn't sit next to you and put his arm around you and say, okay, how do we get them to change? I'm pretty sure Jesus would say, both of you need to talk. You both are participating here. Even if you're married to an addict, a serial cheater, it doesn't matter what. I don't care. It doesn't mean Jesus doesn't. At the very least, he's going to say, this is really hard to live with something like this. How do you think you're doing in terms of strength, grace, empathy, courage, making hard decisions? How do you think you're doing? I mean, it doesn't matter if he came to dinner at your house tonight, if he came to dinner at our house, if he rode with us home tomorrow, he'd have something to say. To both of us. here's my answer to the question. It's up on the board. At some point, all couples have to come to terms with our childhood or our upbringing or the things that happened to us that have created what I would call scripts that we're either consciously aware of or not that we bring into marriage. And they play out especially with those we love. I'll tell you one that's it's happened often enough, and it's sort of freaky, because you can have a couple that has had a terrific life romantically and even physically, whether they've held back or not, and you can tell they're not worried about the physical relationship when they get married. And then they get married, and one of the two people shuts down. Like, sometimes on a wedding night or on the honeymoon. And they come into counseling not soon after. And you can tell one person is going, this is baffling to me. What happened? It looked like this would not be a struggle for us. And now we're married. And literally within hours or days or weeks or months, it's dead in the water. It's not happening. And often the story, not always, I don't mean to oversimplify or generalize, but often what emerges is that there is sexual harm or trauma in the life of the one partner that they may have repressed, they may remember, but they haven't really dealt with, or they didn't think it had that much of an effect while they were dating. But when they get married to someone, it seems like when they're now in a family context, all of a sudden, that trauma and the memories associated with sexuality or sexual harm hijack their brain in a way that even they are surprised by, and they feel awful, but they can't do anything about it. It's just an extreme example of what I'm going to talk about here, where all of a sudden, my story, even if I've successfully suppressed it, my story emerges in a way and wreaks havoc on my marital relationship. And neither I nor my partner are prepared. We don't know what to do with the strength of that conviction. And maybe an obvious statement to you. A lot of these scripts that we learned at a very young age. And many of them, the strongest ones, are forged in pain. The agreements that spiritual warfare people talk about is a different way to talk about these scripts, where things happen that we have to adapt to and defend against, and we make these vows and we make these decisions that my life will never have this in it, or will always have this in it, or no one will ever treat me this way, or I will always run when X happens. And those kinds of vows can be buried deep, and they can be really immature, the kind of decision that a four-year-old would make. And we have no idea in our conscious adult brain how much power those early decisions and vows and scripts have. Here's a sample, just from my week, of how this plays out in my office. Oops, wrong sheet. There's a couple that came in, and they've been with me for quite a while now. And the wife is very practical, and at the end of every session, she says, "Okay, everybody, grade the session. But great." And she says this, something like this. She goes, "Look, I grew up, my father was in the military, and he was a commander, let's call him a commander, and I always tried to please him. So when my husband rates me an F, which the idiot did once, or gives me a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10, then I try to get him to give me clear things I can do to change the number." You see the script? That's all she knows. How do I get the better score? How do I get the competitive answer? She was also a competitive athlete. That's the drive she has. Interestingly, his father was an abusive bully. And his mom was too passive. So the last thing he wants is to be treated like he's a dictator. Can you see the conflict? Just in those three sentences, can you imagine what kind of tension these two people have? And the problem is, he's a very opinionated man. And again, if I had a magic wand, I'd change him. If I think, and I do, welcome to my world, I think, what would it be like for me to be married to him? I'd have to imagine myself as a woman, but... And what would it be like for me to be married to her? And it's not hard for me, in most cases, if you came in to see me for couples counseling, which thankfully you won't, but if you did, I'd be like, okay, which one would I rather not be married to? Why? That's the person I'd want to change. But invariably, the answer to that question is because there's still a lot of stuff that they're carrying around. There's still a lot of stuff in their baskets that they're carrying around that makes it difficult to interact with them, to love them. Here's another one. This is painfully common. This is a guy who's in his 50s. I can't stand looking at my wife. She's too fat. And I've always been repulsed by that since I was a kid. Now he's very sincere. I think he's actually embarrassed that that's how he thinks. But he's not alone. And I think to myself, wow, you're 56 years old, and you're still looking at females through that lens in such a way that it really affects your attitude towards them and how you treat them. And honestly, if you were standing right next to me, you'd go, I know. He would say, I know. And he would say, why haven't you helped me get that out of my brain? He'd try to blame me. But it's that ingrained in him. My wife demands we move back near her family. She can't say no to anyone but me. And if I don't actively search for jobs near her family, she gets depressed, she storms off, or she punishes me. They're in their late 40s, and he has a terrific job, and she doesn't care. My wife insists that she go on my shooting trips with my buddies, but resents me getting up and being so excited to be there, that she makes me miserable in the morning, but she won't stay home alone. I made a commitment in high school to serve God in Africa. I told her it was part of saying yes to my proposal. Sounds like me. Now we have 4 kids, she's pregnant, and I want to go, and she's balking. That's not fair. He wanted a dog. Surprise, he grew up with dogs, and he travels all the time. Guess who's training the dog and caring for the dog? And guess who didn't grow up with dogs? In my marriage, my father was an angry alcoholic. My mother was a cold workaholic. And so my brother and sister and I all, and we were in the military, we were a military family, so we all learned every man for himself. You learned how to survive as an individual and entertain yourself. The highlights of growing up were playing games and watching movies and TV and eating. My wife grew up with a divorced family, as I said. Her older brother was abusive, and she's in the middle, so she took care of the house and her little sister. Her mom and stepfather were lead singers in a band that traveled all over the state of Maine. So she grew up being very responsible, being very nurturing to her sister, and the one that had to watch out for all the damage that her brother was inflicting. So she wanted stability and intimacy. She didn't want to have to take care of somebody, but she wanted partnership. And she resented that her stepfather watched sports and TV all the time and that she resented what he, all the ways he ate in an unhealthy manner. And that when they played games with the stepfather, he was always highly competitive and made game playing miserable. Now she's married to somebody who likes to eat, play games, watch sports and movies and TV for relaxation and comfort. Can you imagine? We've had a few conflicts about all of those things. We do host an Oscars party every year because I've actually converted or perverted her, whichever, to be a movie person. Anyway, just a sample. Can you see, it doesn't matter how old you are, can you see that if we look in our life, we have made decisions, we have traditions, we have habits, we have things that we've developed, especially around areas where there is hurt, where we've been taken advantage of, where we've suffered loss or grief or shame, where we are anxious or afraid, where we've made decisions, I'm not going to do that. Can you? And those scripts, they seem perfectly reasonable to us. And you can see when you're put in that yoke and you're with this partner and they don't share that same history. They don't share that same ideology. They don't share that. You can see how the process of marriage, one of the reasons I love marriage, I really do think it's one of the primary ways God wants to sanctify us. It's the way that he is trying to expose what is holding us back. He wants to break these generational patterns. And he wants to free us of the choices we made as kids where we did not know how to rely on God. We made all kinds of strategies of how to navigate life, how to protect ourselves and how to get what we want and need, and how to escape what was painful. Everybody has those strategies. And all of those strategies are antithetical to intimacy and trust in marriage. And so the process of marriage is how, that's how God is, he's bringing somebody into your life, and if they recognize, I can help you either with kindness and gentleness and understanding, or with brutality and accusation and criticism. And there's no way we don't do the latter. The question is whether we can learn how to do the former. Can we really... You don't have to be a counselor, you don't have to read all these self-help books and that sort of thing, but you do have to, the Bible is adequate to help us understand something about recognizing this is coming from your story, can we talk about it, and it's affecting us. I don't know about you, if you read the story of Isaac and Rebecca, and then Jacob and Esau, and then Jacob gets married, you would think, right, this seems so obvious. Jacob, you grew up in a home where your mother favored you and your father favored your brother. And so you had what shrinks call triangulation, where, and you grew up knowing the damage that's inflicted on a family when there's favoritism. So I assume, Jacob, when you're getting married, if you have children, the one thing you're not going to do is show favoritism to your children, right, Jacob? And then you read the story of Joseph. And his brothers hate him because, guess why? Jacob favors Joseph. You get to wear the coat of many colors. You think, really? How could you do that? You grow up with an alcoholic as a parent. Not at all surprising if you make a decision pretty early on, particularly if it's an unpleasant experience growing up. You say, boy, the last thing I'm going to ever do is marry someone who has an alcohol or a substance problem. I'm determined not to end up with somebody like my mother or my father. And then 20 years into marriage, you realize, are you kidding? They have an addiction to something. And I determined that that was not. I put all my energy into that. I determined I would marry somebody who loved Young Life, who grew up in Young Life, which is a lot tamer than I grew up with an alcoholic. I don't want to marry an alcoholic. And what is it in us that the irony of this is that like Jacob, we can determine something and it still happens because there is something in us that draws us to the unresolved issues. There's actually theories, I don't know if you've read this, there's actually theories about marriage that part of what we're attracted to is the unfinished business in our family, and we want somebody who carries some of that baggage so we can work out our childhood stuff with this person. If you have a daughter who all she seems to date is the bad guys, and you're like, what is your problem? Why are you dating? You're not, well, the good guys, the Christians, you know, they're boring. They're nice, but there's no chemistry. There's nothing there. I'm not really attracted to them. And you're sitting there going, wait a minute, this kid is great. And you like that kid. It's sort of like Grease, right? You like that kid. Why do you like that kid? And she might even say, I know on paper I should like these guys, but this is who I like. In whatever way that plays out, particularly if it doesn't make sense even to your daughter, that's the story. The story is playing out. The theory here is we are going to pick somebody that will replicate the childhood dilemma because we're still trying to fix it. We're still trying to at least understand what happened. Why did my alcoholic father not come through for us? Why am I still trying to understand why he didn't love me or why he treated me or my mom or dad the way they did? So we actually take that on without even knowing it because it factors into what we call chemistry. Okay. Kiwi. So I have a brief skit, which is very timely if you've seen either the documentary or the movie that just came out this past year.
I guess you know that I really love music. In fact, it's been very, very important to me since I was very little. My mom and dad didn't like me to bang when I was angry. But I found that if I played the piano when I was angry, they didn't mind that, so that's what I did. I play like that. And then little by little, I'd see that the music would be sounding less and less angry. So it seemed that the more I played, the more anger got out of me, and I felt better about everything. That's one reason I wrote that song, Good Feeling, because it does give you a good feeling to know that there's something that you can do to help you become the master of the mad that you feel and not have to hurt yourself or anybody else. I hope that you're finding your ways of saying how you feel, ways that don't hurt you or anybody else, really help people to have very good feeling.
Okay, Keely, will you put the exercise up there? All right. Again, just privately, either write this down or just answer in your head these questions. Take 5 minutes. And by the way, if 1 and 4 sound similar, when I read them again this morning, they do seem sort of similar. So just pick one of those two. One more minute. So this time I am going to ask, if you're here by yourself, then I'll give you a separate exercise. But if you're here with either your spouse or someone you're in a relationship with, pick your answers to one of these and just quietly share it with your partner. Even if just one of you shares, just decide. And just see where the conversation goes. Just 2 or 3 minutes, just talk about it. So I'll give you 5 minutes to do that. If you're single or not here with your partner, what I want you to do is use your imagination. Everybody's in a relationship close enough, I hope, where they could share this with somebody. You don't have to be married to be dealing with this. It could be a roommate, it could be a good friend, it could be a sibling, it could even be a parent, but or a grown adult child. But think, if you're here by yourself, who would it be good for me to share this with? Do I want to share it with somebody? Why or why not? So just take 5 more minutes, share with your partner, at least one of you share, and just see where the conversation goes, and then we'll pick it up again. Guy just got his wife's face. It's cute. We can't talk to the mic. Did you have an answer?
You're talking.
Okay, one more minute. A few more comments about this. By the way, it's very awkward when you have a microphone to realize you have to go to the bathroom. And I'm sitting with my wife thinking, okay, I guess I can turn it off. So I'm back on, but we were doing the exercise, and I realized I just have to talk like this. Otherwise, you would all hear. two concepts here, one biblical, one very old secular. The first is a passage that's sort of one of the hallmark passages for our lay counseling, but you can see why it applies here. It's from Proverbs, and it's Proverbs 20, verse 5, which in the NIV reads like this. The purposes of a man's heart are like deep waters, but a man of understanding draws them out. So again, you can tell, I think, from hearing me, I'm a very visual thinker. So when I read passages like that, just like with the yoke thing, I'm trying to think, okay, you're giving us a picture or parts of a picture here. What is this picture telling me? And here's the image for me. You can sort of imagine somebody sitting on a boat here and thinking something like, I just had this massive fight with my spouse over X, and I really lost my mind and really handled it poorly, and then I grabbed the car keys and left. And what God is telling me is, and if my spouse were to say, why do you always do that? Why is that how you handle whenever I bring something up like this? That's how you react. Why do you react like that? And for, again, in our marriage, for years, the honest answer was, I don't know, it's just the way I am. And that sentence, that's where this verse began to make sense to me. Because the image is of somebody in a boat, and what they're saying is, the purposes of my heart are 20 feet down in the water. And when I look over the side of the boat and say, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why am I reacting to criticism the way I react to criticism? Why do I fight it and then turn it on her and then grab the car keys and want to leave? I could recognize that's a pattern, but I didn't know why. And the Proverbs is saying the purposes of my heart are like deep waters. And unless I become a man of understanding, or unless I'm with somebody who is a person of understanding, either they or me, I have to have the wisdom and the desire to actually pull that up to the surface. The purposes of my heart are like deep waters, but a person of understanding draws them up. Meaning, when you can see why you're doing what you're doing, then you have a choice. When you can recognize that's why I'm doing this, that's what's driving this behavior. So a funny story that I often tell in the Glorious Mess Seminar, which, by the way, if you're interested, Janice asked me to promote this. We have several of these cards. If you're interested in the LCI training, I know the church is trying to get a group of people to go up to Northern Virginia. We have seminars April 18th and May 2nd. So if you're interested, grab a card and talk to Janice. So we were in Indiana for this training with Dr. Crabb, and we had one car. This is before cell phones. This is 1983-ish. And so I would take, she's a dental hygienist, she's supporting us, supporting me through grad school. So I would take her to the dentist's office, then I'd go to classes and study, and then pick her up at 5 o'clock. And this is in Warsaw, Indiana, which is sort of northern Indiana, in the middle of nowhere. And at some point, my wife says, "I've all the other people in the office and some friends of ours have said there's one woman who's really good at doing hair, and she's about 45 minutes away in Shipshewana, something like that." And it takes a long time to get in to see her, so I made an appointment, and it's about a month from now. So that particular day, I'm going to talk to the dentist to make sure I can get off, because the appointment's at like 4:15, and it's 45 minutes away, so I'm going to have to take the afternoon off, and you're going to have to come early and pick me up and take me up to get this, to get my hair done. And I say, okay. So the day comes, and she's excited. She reminds me. I drop her off, and I think in the Pinto, probably. And but this is, I don't have sticky notes. There's no phone with notes or memos or alarms or anything like that. But she reminds me, and I know it's important to her. I'm so excited I'm going to get my hair cut with this woman. People rave about her, and now I've got this appointment. Don't forget, pick me up at 3 o'clock. Okay, got it. It's like 8 in the morning. Am I embellishing? Yes. Of course I'm in. Am I embellishing? Wicked. That's a main, if you don't know, that's a main phrase. Like obviously you're embellishing. So I won't forget. Of course, I get to school. I'm taking notes. Life-changing material. I'm doing my homework. Out of my brain. 5 o'clock, I drive up to the dentist's office. My wife comes out, and she's crying, and I think, oh, something bad must have happened at the office there. But then she gets near the car, and I realize she's crying, but there's something else coming out of her eyes. And she's kind, and she just, in tears, with some degree of passion, says, "Where were you?" And I'm like, "What? What do you mean? Like, haircut, remember? I was supposed to get my hair done." And I'm like, oh. So I feel bad for about 10 seconds. And then I do what I think so many husbands do. I'm like, well, come on, get in the car. We can go right now. She's like, they close at 5 o'clock. Idiot. And I'm like, well, okay, maybe let's call. You can get in. She's like, stop it. I have to get time off. She's booked. Well, maybe she's got a cancellation. Again, I'm doing everything I can to fix this, to repair this. And of course, there's no repair to be had. There's nothing that's gonna fix this. And she's still listening for something which isn't even on my radar yet. Because after none of my fix-it attempts work, again, because I grew up in a family where you don't talk about what's going on. If you know this little trio of statements about alcohol outcomes, it doesn't apply to everyone, but it certainly did mine. You grew up, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. So certainly my family never apologized for anything. So I didn't grow up in a family that apologized for stuff. That doesn't cross my brain while I'm sitting there. So I'm trying to fix this, in part to get out of the doghouse, obviously, and in part to get her what she wants. But there's no fix to have. So then, I want to say unconsciously, but then here's what happens. And it's what happened in my family growing up. I shift gears. Now, now I'm like, well, okay, let it go. You just got to make another appointment. But I don't stop there. At some point I go, and I just don't understand why it's so stinking important to you anyway. I mean, it's just a haircut. Isn't there somebody in town who can do a good job? See what's happening, right? You can feel this. But I am not just a jerk. I am a Christian. What'd you say?
Wicked jerk.
What'd you say?
Wicked jerk.
Well, screw you. We fought a lot in my family. I know how to fight, and you'll see why. But I'm not just a jerk, I'm a Christian jerk. I'm a Christian navigator, memorize the Bible jerk. And you don't wanna get in that fight. But if that's the kind of fight, if you fight with knives, you want the person to fight with knives because you're better. So now, when my lame attempts to fix this don't work, I start turning it on her. When I say, why is it so important? And now, again, my wife's not an angry person. She's not a fighter, and she's not generally an angry person. But at this point, she's still trying to find her voice in our marriage because I'm dominating. Again, it's my script she signed up for. And now she's making me feel bad, I'm in a counseling program, but I don't know this language yet. I'm not very good at seeing the purposes of my heart. And I start pushing back. And first I say, why is it so important? There has to be somebody who can do this to your liking. And now I begin to hint, are you so high maintenance that there's only one person that can do your hair this way? And don't you think having your hair be so important is like an idol, is like vanity? Don't you think this is an area that you may need to look at in your life, something like that? Now my wife is like, she's like, And for me, I'm still not getting the response, even now, and you know this in fights, maybe you don't recognize this. If we filmed you and your spouse fighting and put it up on here, like a Dr. Phil, the audience would know this is the relational message you're sending. You may not know you're sending it, but the audience can tell you are trying to make this her fault. And you're trying to make her feel bad because she was excited about something she cares about, and you blew it, and you're trying to pin it on her. The whole audience. If Dr. Phil was here and said, you get to vote, who do you like better, the wife or the husband here? Only another Christian jerk like me would pick me. Everybody would say, we feel sorry for you, honey. So none of my attempts to make this thing go away change. And now we're really clashing. And she's gone silent, which is what she does when she's being bullied. She just goes quiet. Well, that gets me a little more fired up. And ordinarily, if I get that fired up, I start cussing because I grew up in a non-believer's home. My dad was in the Navy. I know how to do that. And then finally, I just get exasperated. I'd start pounding the counter, not her, but I'd start pounding the counter, and finally I'd say, I'm going to take the car keys and go cool off. Again, the message, because you're not giving in, because you're not reading the script. But I'm in a counseling program. And it was at this particular point, because Larry Crabb had taught this illustration about what do you do with your emotions. And he'd say the core emotions, like anger and fear and guilt, are like the lights on your dashboard in the car. And when that light comes on, when you see that light come on, it's like the oil light coming on. So when anger comes on, or shame comes on, or fear comes on, the basic thing you should do, like in your car, is pull over. Take a breath and see what's going on. And he taught us to ask ourselves the question when we're getting, I would now call it, when we get flooded with anger, fear, shame, guilt, that's the time you want to pull over and say, what's going on? What am I trying to do right now? What am I trying to accomplish? I'm demanding something of my wife. What is it? So we're in the middle of this fight, and I'm getting exasperated, and all of a sudden, I kid you not, I hear this little voice in my head. which is like, I'm pretty sure it's the voice of Larry Crabb. And he's saying, what are you feeling right now? Anger. What's your goal? I'm trying to shut my wife up. Why? Because you're making me feel bad. So let me get this straight. You're trying to shut your wife up because she's telling you you're being a bad husband. Yes. And the way you're doing that is by being a bad husband. Yes. And you want to keep doing that. Yes. Even though it doesn't work. Yes. And at some point, the dialogue with this imaginary Larry Crabb begins to sink in. At some point, a man of understanding draws the purposes up, and I see what I'm doing. Two things happen. I immediately calm down. That's what pause can do to flooding. Just give yourself a break. Okay, wait a minute. What am I doing here? I am making this worse. I could at least admit that. And then I could stop. Now, she, fortunately, has not given up on me. She's watching this whole thing. And she doesn't know this conversation is going on because she can't hear him like I can, because he's in my head. Strange. But she's curious because she can tell something's changing in my countenance. And I calm down, and eventually I can say, I'm sorry for the initial thing, which, you know, in hindsight, like, dummy, just apologize for the simple thing. You keep doing what you do, you got a whole lot more to confess afterwards. This is not about forgetting something important to your wife. This is how you treat your wife in conflict. Which, by the way, that's what most marital conflict is about. It starts with something relatively small, but eventually it becomes about the way we treat each other in conflict. That's the repetitive thing. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning. So, I calm down, and finally, in some awkward attempt, I try to apologize and make amends. And of course, after we sort of patch things up, she wants to know, so what happened? Because you broke script. You didn't do what you normally do when we fight. So tell me what happened. So I told her about my imaginary Larry and about the goals and desires and stuff, and she's like, good to know. And don't you know? She's not a dumb woman. The next time we fight, it's pretty early in the fight. And at some point she goes, what's your goal right now? Don't you and Larry need to have a little conversation there? Here's the idea from the secular world. And I offer it again because I think it's pocket theology. It's very simple. You don't have to buy the book or read any of it. I'm not even sure I'm telling the theory right. But it's from something in the 50s called transactional analysis, which is a really odd spin-off of Freud. But the id, ego, and superego, that if you ever took Psych 101. So transactional analysis just basically says we have the capacity to act like a parent, an adult, or a child. And what I'm simplistically arguing is when we put into either one of these modes, it's coming from our past. And we're married to somebody who can be in one of those modes. And the simple way to think about how do I know when childish or childlike scripts are playing out is because, and this is just a way to think, what mode am I in this conversation with my spouse? Like, we're having this fight about the hair thing, and it's not hard to see when I realize I've done something bad, I go into the bad child thing. Whenever a husband says I'm in the doghouse, which is frequent, right? And I know you've noticed that there's really no equivalent phrase, sort of like the books in the bookstore, there's not an equivalent phrase for the woman, right? It's not that women don't know what the doghouse is, but we don't talk about women and being in a doghouse, and I can't think of There's certainly no cat house. There's no nothing else. There's nothing else that we put the wife in. This is a phenomenon because I think males, you know, it says our frontal lobotomy kicks in about 28 or 38, 48, take your pick, somewhere. So we're a little more hardwired to be a child, particularly if you grow up in a home like mine. And my wife, because of her background, is a little more wired to be the parent, because that's some of the roles she grew up in. So, like, she just texted when she answered one of the questions, since she wrote where she answered the question, what's an area where I still tend to parent you? Not surprised. I can't think of an answer where I try to parent you. I mean, I guess I tried with Bible study or something at some point. It may take the role of teacher or any kind of boss or anything like that. It's still, you're treating your spouse like you have authority, like you have the what they need in order to be a better person. So you're pushing that on them. And it's just easier because I think I do behave more childishly in conflict than she does, and she behaves more over-responsibly in conflict. But no surprise here. If you go into child mode, you see the dilemma that it puts your spouse in. They're either going to go in the flesh in us, our natural instinct. If I'm giving her a child who's fighting with her, who doesn't want to get in trouble and is mad that they're getting in trouble or being held accountable, it's either going to trigger, it's going to be hard for her to handle that well. She's more naturally going to go into the parent mode, or she's going to go into child mode, which for her means back away. Protect yourself and try to keep distance. So don't engage the bully verbally or it'll get worse. And that's her little girl behavior with bullying. So it's a very simple way. Transactional analysis is just a way to think, wait a minute, how are we behaving right now? Again, this is just cheap shorthand. What's it like to relate to me right now? Am I acting like an adult, a parent, or a child? That's really all I'm giving you. It's just a simple way to get to, can we get to where we're talking about what really matters? Can we get to where I can see the purposes driving my behavior? Which, again, that requires a certain level of willingness to admit we're being defensive. And I want you to have grace and empathy for this. All of our defensiveness is forged in pain. We've learned to be defensive because of our story. It's how we have coped with life. And if you want to be an adult who's interacting with somebody who's having a hard time being an adult and is in defense mode, is in threat mode, is in attack mode, is in bully mode, is in avoid, run, shut down, freeze, all of the things, they're being flooded, they are experiencing something painful inside, and in the moment they're blaming you for causing all of that flooding, which is just what a kid would do. And it takes grace. It takes the ability not just for the offender to stop and think, what am I doing, but for the person on the other end of the immature behavior also to stop and think, okay, like, you're really bugging me right now, you're really annoying me, you're really making me question why I married you, you're really making me think all kinds of things. And what I could think is, what do you need me to do, despite how badly you're treating me? What is it I could do for you right now? Lord, I need help to know what to do here. There's a passage in Galatians chapter 6, and it's written to elders, I think, or pastors or people in that. It says, you who were spiritual, when someone is caught in a sin, restore them gently. And be careful lest you be tempted also. Now, when you read that verse, if you read that verse, you'd kind of go, okay, all right, well, what's this you'd be tempted thing? If you're an elder, And you have a case come before you in the church, and it's, you can see this passage directly applies, okay, we should, you know, this brother has been caught in sin, and we're bringing him before the elder board, and we need to try and restore them gently. Okay, I need to be gentle. The more conservative or careful about theology, or as Steve shared, the more legalistic we tend to be in the church, the harder it is for us to restore gently. We tend to take discipline more seriously as a church function, but we have trouble with the word gentle. So if you're an elder, you kind of get, okay, I need to be gentle. I'm saying that to everybody in the room. That's why I read the love passage. Paul is saying, can you understand love is really mature? The love I'm describing is not childish, it's mature. And it believes in the best. And it's gentle for the most part. And it doesn't give up. It stays with the program here. And it believes in the other person. It believes there's an adult there who's being lost because of the defensiveness. And it wasn't until I thought, why is Paul saying to the elders, and be careful lest you're tempted? And I thought, when does an elder get tempted? When does anyone who has authority get tempted? When does someone who knows what's really happening get tempted? When do you think, I'm not behaving like a kid, you are, what are you then tempted to do? Now you can see the temptation. Now I'm going to speak down to you. Now I'm going to treat you. The temptation is to take that authority and add to the shame and add to the accusation and try to force repentance or change. And I'm not sure, but I think that's potentially one of the things Paul's alluding to. I just know in counseling, I can see it. Everyone who works with couples, where you can see one person's story is really taking over the relationship. The partner is never neutral. The partner is either a help in the process of this person trying to discover what in the world is going on for me. The partner either helps or really hinders the process. I either want them in the room, and then many times in marriage counseling, what happens is you begin to realize, I don't think the marriage is going to get much better until we deal with the individual issues of this person. Because that's the person who keeps getting flooded, and they're the ones who keep creating the damage that plays out in the marriage, and the marriage is paying for the sins of the past. So it's not unusual to say, okay, I need to work with the individual here, or someone needs to work with the individual, and we may need to even put a pause on the marriage counseling. Rarely, but sometimes, it's actually helpful to have the partner stay in the individual work, because they really want to be a help, and they realize, I live with them. And I, in many cases, am the surrogate perpetrator in their life. And I have the capacity to offer something different than they got in their story. But it's a rare spouse who can see that. It's a rare woman who can stay in the room while I'm talking to a man about his porn addiction. Because she realizes, if I stop reacting to this and taking it all so personally, I may be able to help. That's a rare woman. I'm not saying every woman should be able to do that. I think that's very difficult. But I can tell you, when that happens, it makes a difference. When you have somebody who's an adult survivor of childhood abuse of any kind, and the partner is there going, okay, what do I need to read? How do I help? How can I stop taking this so personally? You don't want to have sex with me anymore. How do I stop taking that so personally? I need help. I'm willing to read. I'm willing to try and be an adult here and actually help you in this recovery process. Again, that's a rare partner, but if you have that partner, I actually want to keep them in the room if the now client wants them there. And I'm telling you, that may be one out of 20 times, because it's hard to be the partner in this story. It's hard not to keep taking it personally. It's hard for her not to take it personally when she's paying for my family of origin. and all the behaviors that have been so ingrained in me. This is one of the things that marriage does. A little different than being yoked together. Just an awareness that in the closeness of intimacy, stuff that happened to us when we were first thrust into the intimacy of a family, stuff that happens, that tends to surface. And in surprising, sometimes maddening ways. And we have an opportunity to be the hands and feet of Jesus with our spouse, if we're willing to. It does take grace and forgiveness. That's why it's so important. If you haven't taken the yoke off yourself, you don't know the power of grace. It's pretty hard. We can only give the grace we've received. It requires empathy. Can I really understand what you're going through and stop taking it so personally? Hard to do. If we don't do it, it only exacerbates the repetition of the conflict, because that hidden stuff will continue to surface and create tension and disappointment. And before you know it, you're starting to not want to go home, or you're starting to think about other things, or they go to bed at 10 and you stay up till 2 and all that kind of thing, because you feel sort of like, yeah, well, nothing's going to change. That's not what the driver of the wagon is saying to us. That's what our story, that's what our flesh is saying. I'm done trying to do this. I'm done trying to be Christ. I'm done trying to be supportive and empathetic and gentle. When I was a child, I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. I'm going to add, I reacted like a child. When we get to heaven, well, finally, when we get to heaven, it's gone. We're just adults. And we will be able to love fully as we are fully loved. A bit ironic. When I get to heaven, I'll have empathy. But everybody else will too. And there's nothing to be empathetic about, so to speak. And again, the madness of God is that he calls us to do these things even though we're broken inside ourselves. That's the mystery. That's the paradox. We're broken people in love with broken people in a broken world with an enemy, and he is calling us to be people who give grace, who understand, who care, who stay, who try to live by that love definition. Despite our flesh fighting it inside. All right, are we done? Yes, 12 o'clock.
Let's pray. Father, thank you for all the things that we've been taught. We pray, Lord, that you would help us to process them with each other. Lord, would you continue to feed us as we think on these things? And thank you for lunch. Amen.